Evening, Stephen. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, you're coming through loud and clear. It is my privilege this evening to be joined by Stephen Singular, the author of the recent book Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. The book is published in soft cover by Dove Books, copyright 1995. Stephen, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you for having me.
Your book actually is about far more than just Mark Furman, racism in the LAPD. In fact, I would say that Mark Furman plays a relatively small part in your book. The author Edith Wharton observed, Stephen, that in a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys. And I think that in connection with the O.J. Simpson case, our society has proved itself to be altogether frivolous, and it has destroyed a great deal, including some very serious information, which you have effectively and courageously highlighted, that O.J. Simpson was framed. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be, how you came into possession of the information that you did?
Well, in 1984, I was living in Denver, Colorado. I had been kind of a radio junkie for many years. I had moved to Colorado a few years before that and became fascinated with a radio personality named Alan Berg, who was a prominent figure there on the radio. And in June of 1984, he was assassinated by a group of neo-Nazis from the northwest of America. They were all subsequently rounded up, tried in Seattle, and convicted, or they pled guilty, and most of them are now in federal penitentiaries.
This group, by the way, was named The Order.
Yes, it was. And it was led by a man named Robert Matthews, who was killed in a shootout with the FBI at the end of 1984. At the time, before the Oklahoma City bombing, these people were essentially responsible for three or four deaths. They robbed $4.6 million in one heist in Northern California and committed 270, I believe it was 270 criminal acts. Anyway, the point of all of that is that an investigation of FBI and police personnel was conducted throughout the United States to round these people up. I made a lot of contacts, got to know a lot of people, wrote my book. It came out in 1987. It was called Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg. And I stayed in touch with some of the sources that I developed at that time in the mid-1980s. There was, of course, a lot of research being done by police and other officials into right-wing organizations, white supremacist organizations, and groups like that. When the murders occurred in Brentwood here in Los Angeles in June of 1994, I watched what followed that. I, like 90 million other Americans, watched the high-speed chase, watched Simpson taken into custody, et cetera, and came to what I believed was what appeared to be the conclusion that he was a guilty man. 6 weeks passed after that to late July of 1994, and I was contacted by a source that I had made 10 years earlier, roughly, a source connected to the legal system out here.
Out here being in Los Angeles.
Southern California, and was told that there were several critical pieces of evidence in this case that basically had not surfaced that would go a long way toward explaining what had happened, at least in one aspect of the case, the aspect being what the police had done.
You mentioned that a stick and a blue evidence bag found respectively on O.J.'s property
right. And
adjacent to it figured prominently in this scenario. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, this was the first week of August now of 1994, and I was given four pieces of information at that time. One is that there was a piece of broken fence that was germane to the case. Two was that there was a blue plastic evidence bag that was germane to the case. Both were recovered. One was recovered near the Ford Bronco. The stick was recovered near the Ford Bronco by the police, and the bag was recovered over near where the glove had been found on Simpson's estate. If you recall the pictures of all of that, there's his house, there's the walkway, there's a chain link fence, and on the other side of the fence there's a blue plastic object lying on the ground. I was told that was an evidence bag, which is something that homicide detectives take with them when they go to crime scenes. We know from preliminary hearing testimony that, in fact, Detective Furman and Detective Phillips, who were the first homicide detectives to arrive on the scene had a homicide kit in their trunk that contained plastic bags. I didn't know, and I was also told that blood had been planted in this case, and the only thing needed to prove that was to test the blood, the crime scene blood, and perhaps other blood for a preservative. Technically, it's called an anticoagulant. It's called EDTA. It's a preservative in blood, so it won't coagulate when you put it in a vial. You draw blood from a suspect, you put it in a vial, you don't want it to harden or get dry, so there's a preservative in there. If Simpson's blood had been planted, it would have had to have come out of that vial. If it were tested and it had EDTA in it, it would clearly mean that it had, in fact, been planted. The fourth piece of information I was given was that Detective Mark Furman had known Nicole Simpson fairly well prior to these crimes. We all know he'd gone over to Simpson's estate once in 1985. He testified, or he wrote a report in 1989, that this made an indelible impression on him. But that's the end of the story, basically. I was told that he was in somewhat of regular communication with her, that he was her cop on the force, that she told him about her relationship with O.J. in depth. And the point of all that being that he did not arrive at the crime scene as any kind of a blank slate, as a homicide investigator would be expected to do.
Now, we should stress that none of this has ever been firmly established. And I shouldn't say none of this, but with regard to the situation vis-a-vis Furman and the Simpson family. Has there ever been any objective finding in a court of law?
What happened in that example is, I mean, we can go through the four pieces of information one at a time, but what happened was that to sort of give you a narrative progression, I got the information. I didn't quite know what to do with it. I was told that approaching the prosecution would not do any good. Nobody was going to listen to me, and I was just going to get into trouble. So I approached the defense and put these things in a fax. And I faxed it to Johnny Cochran's office on August 4th of 94, and 4 days later I was sitting in Shapiro's office with Carl Douglas, who was Cochran's second-in-command, and with Bill Pavlik, who was their lead investigator. I gave them those four pieces of information. I told Pavlik and Douglas that Furman knew Nicole Simpson, and Pavlik was all over me. He's a tough ex-cop from L.A. who thought he knew everything about the case and probably did know more than anybody. And he said he'd looked at all the clubs and all around to see if they did have a connection, and he couldn't find one. But to answer your question, is that the trial began in January of 1995, as we all know.
Right.
In February of 1995, the LAPD began conducting their own internal affairs investigation of Mark Furman because enough stuff had come out about him to at least make them conduct a token investigation, which is what it essentially amounted to. What happened was that, you know, the crimes were committed in June of 94. The preliminary hearing was in July. In August and July of 94, deputy district attorneys, two by name, Lucien Coleman and Julie Segosian, came forward to the district attorney's office, to Marcia Clark, to Bill Hodgman, to Garcetti, to the people in charge, and said a couple of things. One is that police themselves had approached these deputy DAs and had told them about Furman being at parties, Furman being at other locations, and talking about, for one example, Nicole Simpson's breast implants. He was bragging about seeing them. He was talking about it with other cops. What does that tell you? Does that tell you that they had a relationship? I don't know, but it tells me that there was something in what I was being told. When other policemen were coming forward talking to the deputy DAs, the deputy DAs in turn were going to the higher-ups and saying, look, this is not normal behavior. Regardless of what happened, this man may very well have had an incentive to do the kinds of things that were now being talked about by the defense.
We should note that this was discussed in an article that appeared on the front page of the Los Angeles Times, albeit near the bottom where an awful lot of people don't look. I don't recall the possible issue of Furman and Nicole as romantic or possible romantic or sexual partners coming out in court. There were reports in the papers, but most of what I was driving at is that most of the rest of the information that you had been given did come out to one extent or another, and frequently obliquely during the course of the trial, yet it was virtually ignored even by the participants.
Well, what happened was that the stick Furman had mentioned a stick in the preliminary hearing. It was connected to absolutely nothing. It was, when I went back and looked at his preliminary hearing testimony, I found that he was talking about this, and which struck me as very curious. I talked about that with the defense. Then as the trial began, I mean, I'm leaving out many details, one of which is that I wrote all of this up in a book proposal, which was then leaked to everybody, including the prosecuting attorneys and the defense attorneys and the judge, so that they all sort of knew some of the things that the defense was going to do in the trial. They knew the stick had become an issue by the fall of 1994. So when Furman took the stand in March of 95, you may recall that Marcia Clark would like to end each Friday. They would quit on Friday at noon, and she would like to end it with something very dramatic. They would bring out a glove, or they would bring out... You know, there was that fiasco with the plastic bag that was in the Bronco, which happened to be a standard issue item. They thought it was a body bag or something. But anyway, one Friday they brought this object wrapped in brown paper and set it in front of Mark Furman, and he unwrapped it, and it was this piece of stick. But what was it? Nobody ever said, where did it come from? I was told it came from a fence over at the Bundy address at the crime scene, that he broke a piece of stick off of the fence there, that he picked up the glove with the stick, that he put the stick in a blue plastic evidence bag, that he transported the bag, the glove, the stick over to Rockingham, that he dropped the glove on the ground, that he got rid of the stick in the bag. We know these objects exist. We know the stick was introduced in court. We know that the defense introduced the picture of the blue plastic bag to the jury also in February when Cochran was cross-examining one of the homicide detectives.
This plastic bag lying right on the other side of a cyclone fence from where the infamous bloody glove was found.
Was found at Simpson's estate.
And this was actually a blue evidence bag of the type that detectives carry in an evidence kit.
That is my understanding. I mean, I never held it in my hand, but I do know that Cochran introduced it into evidence with that. And then when Bailey was cross-examining Furman, went into this whole thing about if you put a glove into a blue plastic bag, what would happen with it? See, I got close to the defense, and Carl Douglas gave me the preliminary hearing transcripts of Furman and Vinatter, which they gave in July of 1994. I studied Furman's testimony very clearly. He says several things in there that should have been pursued much more strongly than they were. One thing he says in there, off the top of his head, about arriving at the crime scene, is that he knew that Nicole and OJ had joint custody of their children. How does he know that? How can a homicide detective possibly know that, talking about arriving at a crime scene? What does that tell you? This is an admission from his own mouth. The point of the plastic bag was that it would dry, a glove would dry if it were sitting on the ground for 7 or 8 hours, if it were not wrapped in something. I mean, this was according to F. Lee Bailey during the trial. The point I'm making is that the stick entered the trial, the bag entered the trial. The report of the LAPD investigation did surface very late in the trial, but it did not really get much in front of the jury. But the most interesting issue of all, by far, was the blood preservative, because that played a crucial role in the trial.
Now, this EDTA preservative is apparently something that is placed as a matter of course and for the purposes desired for EDTA in a particular type of vial that is color-coded by cap, is it not?
There are three types of vials, and there are three types of preservatives. There's a green, a yellow, and a purple capped vial. Yellow and green have something called sulfurin or heparate, and I believe I pronounced that correctly. I'm not a chemist. When I was originally given this information, as I told you, in late July of 94, one of the first things I did was contact a blood specialist at a hospital in Denver, a man named Dr. Dan Imbruscio, who's a hematologist. I had asked around for some people, and they said, this man knows more about blood and testing blood than anybody you're going to meet. So I called him up, and he explained to me about these caps, about blood preservatives, about what they do. He told me that EDTA was a stable compound, and that means that it would be in the blood, you know, long after it came out of the vial. It would not dissolve, so you could test that blood for a long time afterward and still find the chemical in there. which was, a good thing for my purposes. I took all of this information and gave it to the defense, and my general thrust was to get them to test the blood. If that chemical was in there, then we could fairly safely assume that we knew at least a portion of what happened in this case. I mean, that's a provable thing. If you talk to any organic chemist, he'll tell you that.
How did the defense react to your information?
They told me I was wrong about everything. They told me I was wasting their time. It's a very interesting story. It's laid out in the book. I rather naively thought, well, they'll embrace this information. They may even embrace me. Because if this stuff is true, then you get beyond speculation. You get into some hard evidentiary stuff that could really show you some severe police misconduct.
Now, again, the significance of this EDTA is not as obscure as it might appear at first glance. Its presence in some of the blood samples supposedly left by O.J. Simpson at various elements of the crime pathway, I guess one could say, would positively prove that blood had been planted from the sample that O.J. had given to the police.
Correct. That's correct.
And this would have obviously proved that O.J. Simpson had been framed.
That's correct. If you could test it and if you could get definitive answers. I went to the defense to back up a little bit. They said, A, Furman and Nicole did not know each other. B, we've never heard of a stick. C, we've never heard of a blue plastic bag. D, this blood preservative theory is crazy. We can't get our hands on the blood to test it, and if we could, we don't think it's in there anyway. So go back to Denver and have a nice life.
That initial response was not altogether, shall we say, not altogether ingenuous.
No, and it wasn't. It was not. But anyway, I was not willing to just take no for an answer and just go home and resume my former life. I thought if this were true, it had to come out, period. So I began to establish a relationship with Carl Douglas, again, the second command in Cochran's office, and was calling him two or three times a week and was actually able to get my hands on more information and pass it along to him. He went to his evidence book, his murder book, as they're called in criminal trials, and he opened it up and he started thumbing through it. And lo and behold, he found a picture of a blue plastic bag sitting next to a cyclone fence. And he found a piece of stick sitting on the ground next to the Bronco. At that point, I began to be able to get him on the phone a little more easily. And we began to be able to talk to one another, and he started to trust me a little bit. When I arrived in their offices on August 8th, as Carl emphatically pointed out to me, they had had 200,000 leads. They had 200,000 tips, and most of them were, they dismissed them out of hand. He said, we've taken about 100 seriously, and we've sat down and talked to 10 or 15 people. So, you've accomplished something by getting into our office, but we've got to go further. So we did go further, and as I said, some of these things began to check out. So what I did was gather a lot more information on EDTA, how you would test for it, what the test is called. It's called gas chromatography. It essentially separates the EDTA out from the blood, and so you can see that it's in there. And I, again, established more and more of a relationship with Carl in particular. And then what happened is, the story just gets more and more complex, but they began to believe that something had gone on in the crime lab with Simpson's stored blood, and the essence of it was that at a crime scene, the criminalists, as you'll recall in this case, the infamous Fung and Mazzola, go over to a crime scene and take swatches and pick up blood. This gets rather complicated, but the blood preservative theory was shot down by everybody because a number of police officers arrived at that scene and saw that blood on the ground while Simpson was still in Chicago. So if you follow what I'm saying, in other words, you had maybe 10 police officers there who walked through the scene and saw this blood on the ground, and they all testified to that. So that clearly could not have come out of the vial yet, because the vial with the blood in it did not yet exist. When I went to the defense, I said simply, you have to check the crime scene blood. I didn't have any information beyond that. What they did beyond that was to come up with the belief that, in fact, that blood was collected off the ground, that that blood does belong to somebody, but that's not the blood that was sent off to Cellmark for the DNA testing. And if you'll recall Dr. Lee testifying at the trial, that was the essence of what he had to say. I mean, he's generally considered to be the most respected forensic scientist in the world.
Let's recap here just for a second,
yeah.
Stephen. Cellmark Diagnostics was the laboratory that was actually doing the DNA tests.
Correct.
On some of the blood given by O.J. Simpson and stored in that purple cap vial characterized by an EDTA preservative.
Well,
In other words, the blood that was in the vial would have to have had EDTA in it.
Here, let me try and break it down into sort of the theory of the case from the defense's point of view and perhaps from the prosecution's point of view. The critical pieces of evidence in this case, in my opinion, and I think the opinion of many, were blood drops 47 through 52, because those were the crime scene blood drops. If Simpson's blood is on the ground at that crime scene, there's a pretty fair chance that he committed these crimes. And that blood was collected before he came back from Chicago and gave his blood. And then some blood, some Simpson blood, was sent off to Cellmark. The implications from Dr. Lee's testimony were that those blood swatches were switched, because Andrea Mazzola's initials were not on the swatches that were sent off, which was considered very important to them, and because that's what they believe happened, and that's very much in line with what I was told happened. But what happened was, as the case went on, and they began to believe in the blood preservative theory and the fact that Simpson's blood had been planted, they came to me and they said, "Do you know anybody in the crime lab?" And I said, "Well, I can look into it." And they said, "We have reason to believe that some crime lab employee, maybe on orders from above, has taken some of that stored blood and has put it on clean swatches, not the crime scene swatches, but new swatches, and they've sent those off to Cellmark. If they sent those off to Cellmark, they could only come back as O.J. Simpson's DNA. I mean, there's no other way, because it is Simpson's blood. And the tests that Cellmark runs are not tests for EDTA. They're simply tests for DNA, and those tests are not, you know, the same. So I came out to Los Angeles. I was living in Denver at the time, and I approached somebody in the crime lab, and I tried to make headway with what they were asking me to do, and then the story gets a little more complicated and hairy from there, because basically they were trying to get me to do some things that were a little bit questionable, as I subsequently found out. And I really decided that I'd probably gone about as far with them as I wanted to. I was not, as I say in the book, going to stand in the bushes down at the criminal, you know, down at the crime lab and try and jump somebody and get them to talk to me on their behalf.
It certainly wouldn't be a good idea given the publicity for this case. Stephen, I'd like to sum up a few of the points that we've made in this half hour, then take a short break, and we will continue within our next half hour segment. You wrote a book called Talk to Death, the basis for Oliver Stone's 1988 or 9 film, called Talk Radio, about the murder of Alan Berg by the neo-Nazi group The Order. And you were contacted by a source within the L.A. legal system and told that there had apparently been a number of different elements of fabrication of evidence against O.J. Simpson, including the planting of a glove involving a stick to scoop it up and a blue plastic evidence bag to carry it over. A stick was found near the Bronco at O.J.'s property. A blue plastic object, apparently a bag, was found just on the other side of a cyclone fence adjoining O.J.'s property where the glove was found. And you were told that blood had been planted at the crime scene, and that also perhaps swatches of blood from the crime scene had been switched for swatches taken from O.J.'s blood sample. A lot of this panned out during the course of the trial. One of the things that's amazing to me is that Carl Douglas showed you a picture from the evidence book of the blue glove and of the stick, and then Johnny Cochran actually mentioned the blue plastic object, not the blue glove, but the blue bag. Johnny Cochran actually mentioned the blue plastic object at one point during the trial, and yet it was never brought up. Stephen, what I'd like to do would be to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue with an examination of the fascinating and very important, though sadly overlooked, information in your very important, though sadly overlooked book, Legacy of Deception. I've been speaking with Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, softcover Dove Books, copyright 1995. We will be back with Stephen Singular and a discussion of his book in the next half-hour segment.